Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman, Concord's Field Director Phil Smith, and Director of Health Policy for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Josh Gordon, will join the show to discuss PAYGO, sequestration, infrastructure, CRFB's Health Savers Initiative, and more. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has directed several committee chairs to begin working with their GOP counterparts to craft a, quote, big, bold, and transformational infrastructure package. This likely signals a start to what could be the first bipartisan legislative package of Joe Biden's presidency. But some Republicans may be reticent to work with Democrats after the party went ahead with a massive coronavirus relief package that passed last week without a single GOP vote. Speaker Pelosi cited a history of bipartisanship when it comes to big transportation bills, and she said that she hopes that bipartisan tradition can be expanded to reach consensus on, quote, critical needs in energy and broadband, education and housing, water systems, and other priorities. She said guiding principles for the legislation will include provisions' impact on the federal budget, on creating economic growth, and on preserving our planet. If Republicans opt not to make a deal, there's another budget reconciliation process available to Democrats, but there are divisions within the party on whether that's a good idea, as well as on what policies should be included in a second filibuster-proof budget bill. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman, and Director of Health Policy for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Josh Gordon, will join the show to discuss CRFB's Health Savers Initiative with a special focus on Medicare and hospital-related costs. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby, Tori Gorman, and Josh Gordon. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tori is Concord's Policy Director. Both are regular contributors on the show. Josh is Director of Health Policy for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, where he leads its research into the effects of federal policies on health and the healthcare system. He spearheads the Health Savers Initiative, a joint project of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Arnold Ventures, and West Health, which works to identify bold and concrete policy proposals to make healthcare more affordable. It's actually what we're going to talk a little bit about today. Prior to joining CRFB, Josh was a senior healthcare policy fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. Prior to that, he was actually our colleague at Concord, spending 18 years as the policy director. He's also taught at the George Washington University Graduate School of Political Management. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob, Tori, and Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jason.
Happy to have you all on the program. Good to have you back, Josh. And I'm going to take the cheap way out with the start of this interview and actually kick it over to Tori as we start diving into CRFB's Health Savers Initiative.
Yeah, I just wanted to set the stage real quick. And Josh is going to ask you if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the Health Savers Initiative and why it's important.
Well, I think it's important because as I hope your listeners know, healthcare costs and their growth over time are going to be a major contributor to the federal budget challenge. And what we thought we would do with the Health Savers Initiative is find a way to bridge really good ideas in the think tank world and in health policy research around the country with Capitol Hill. And one of the ways we think we can do that is by scoring some of the really good ideas that are out there, because as I'm sure you're familiar with, Tori, the score for cost savings is a key driver of whether something makes it in a bill and how it's considered. So we thought by putting some meat on the bones of some of these ideas, we could help policymakers make some good decisions about the areas of healthcare that they really need to be focused on as healthcare cost growth continues to impact families, businesses, and of course the federal budget.
Sure. And it sounds like that you're talking about more healthcare policy in general. This isn't siloed particularly towards Medicare or Medicaid. You're talking about broadly healthcare policy in general, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I really liked about this project is that a lot of times if you only focus on savings for the federal budget or the federal government healthcare system, you tend to kind of have misaligned incentives sometimes where you can save money for the federal budget, but it puts more costs onto states or onto families or businesses. And so by scoring kind of it holistically to take into account all those different pieces, we hope to provide policymakers with more information. The CBO sometimes has a harder time scoring things outside of just for federal budget impact. So we're trying to give more of that information to kind of add ideas to the set of options that policymakers should be thinking about.
Well, let's pick it up with some of the options that you're talking about. You've put out three initial papers, all of which have scores, not only for the federal budget, but for Medicare, for private beneficiaries, and for national health expenditures in general. I want to pick up on one that a lot of listeners would be interested in first, and that is the overpayment of Medicare Advantage plans. And some would probably argue in the insurance industry that they're not overpayments, but we'll get into that. It's important because Medicare Advantage is an extremely popular element of Medicare and probably the fastest growing. I mean, just in terms of the number of beneficiaries that sign up for it, it's an alternative to the regular fee-for-service Medicare that's run by individual private insurance plans that compete for a beneficiary's business. Medicare compensates the plans based on bids that they submit. And so the essence of this option is that the reimbursement to the plans from Medicare overcompensates them for the services that they provide. So that's the premise. Could you pick up on exactly what the option would do? And why, I think first, why the overpayment? I mean, why is it that the plans are overcompensated?
So like a lot of options we look at for the Health Savers Initiative, I think this option for Medicare Advantage savings is selected because it's an area where we have kind of misaligned incentives in the design of the program. And those were in large part unintentional. What you have when you have a private insurance option in Medicare is you need to find a way to balance payments between traditional fee-for-service Medicare and the private Medicare Advantage plans so that the Medicare Advantage plans can't make money just by taking the healthier people out of the insurance pool and leaving the sicker individuals with the fee-for-service system. So we do what's called risk adjustment. This happens in health insurance of all types. And Medicare Advantage is no different. The problem with the risk adjustment for Medicare Advantage specifically is that Medicare Advantage plans are incentivized to report on paper as many diagnoses for their patients as possible, because that's how we compile our risk score for those plans. If Medicare Advantage plans have sicker individuals, they get paid more relative to fee-for-service plans. And fee-for-service is what we, how we kind of define the payment. A doctor gets paid based on the services they provide. So it doesn't really matter to that doctor whether he's writing down other diagnoses for those patients that aren't really involved in that specific treatment. But the Medicare Advantage plan is incentivized to do that. So what has happened over time is that Medicare Advantage enrollees are starting to appear sicker and sicker relative to similarly situated fee-for-service beneficiaries. And in reality, they're not sicker. It's just happening on paper. So we kind of define that as an overpayment because they're being paid for sicker patients, even though those patients aren't sicker. And we think there should be payment parity or at least closer to it between Medicare Advantage and fee-for-service. And that winds up, if you correct for it, saving a lot of money. I should also add that right now, the government is actually supposed to adjust for this, which we call coding intensity. And they do adjust for it, but they haven't been adjusting fully. And we think they should adjust more fully.
Give me a kind of a range of the overpayment, because I know this issue has been around for a long time. And it's interesting you point out that the government is supposed to do it, because it appeared that problem had been solved, at least on paper. And as I read your report, it showed that that's not quite the case. But what is the range of overpayment?
This is one of the kind of problems that we tried to confront with our brief, that pretty much everyone agrees that we're not fully adjusting for this problem. In the Affordable Care Act, Congress said there needs to be a minimum adjustment of something like 5.9% reduction in payments to Medicare Advantage plans because of it. That just wasn't enough. And CMS, who kind of administers this program for the federal government, has been a little bit hesitant to adjust more fully because there's no kind of agreed upon way to define the size of this problem. So what we looked at were two different methods. One method that MedPAC has presented to Congress in the past, and one method that we kind of identified in academia that kind of makes a little bit more intuitive sense and is a simpler formula than MedPAC. So beneficiaries and members of Congress maybe can understand it a little better, and it's a little more transparent. And so the overpayments, if you look at these methods, range from about 9% under MedPAC's method to about 15% under our method. And fully adjusting in that range gets you between $200 and $350 billion over a 10-year period. So this is a pretty substantial amount of money going towards Medicare Advantage plans for these overpayments.
Do they make the argument that maybe it's not that they're overcoding, but that fee-for-service undercodes? I mean, if I'm a patient, might I not want to know everything that might possibly be wrong with me? And it's just sort of flipping the argument around.
I think we looked at a bunch of measures of other ways to determine the health of Medicare Advantage enrollees versus fee-for-service enrollees. And these are things like mortality, prescription drug use, and then just basic demographics. And on all of those measures, it's pretty clear that the Medicare Advantage population and the fee-for-service population look almost identical in terms of kind of rates of illness in those definitions. And even Medicare Advantage enrollees are a little bit healthier than fee-for-service enrollees. The only measure that shows Medicare Advantage plans having sicker beneficiaries is on the measure that's currently being used. And that's the measure that's determined by private health insurance plans based on how often they diagnose or report diagnoses. So it's not really the reporting of the diagnoses that's the problem, Bob. We all want our doctors to be thorough like that. It's that they just happen to be getting paid more the more they document those illnesses or in conditions. And I think we would like to not pay them based on the documentation, although we would certainly like them to continue that documentation.
I want to move from that paper to another one on hospital outpatient services. And you have a very interesting paper. This one's really in the weeds. If the last one sounded a little bit weedy, this one is even weedier, but I think it finds a very interesting problem that frankly doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This is a situation where the hospital, the service can cost more depending upon where it is administered. And that doesn't seem to make much sense. If I have a treatment in a particular place, if I go a couple of blocks and have it in a different place, it should cost more. So could you briefly explain why the site neutral payments would save a lot of money?
Yeah, I mean, this has always kind of fascinated me because this is something that's been discussed among health policy experts and federal budget people for many years. In fact, when I talk about this on the Hill, I'm always excited to point out that this is one of those few things that both President Obama and President Trump had in their budget on healthcare. Like everyone kind of agrees that paying differently based on where you have a procedure makes no sense, especially in kind of our modern era of healthcare. Your listeners probably know that sometimes they wind up at what's called an ambulatory surgery center. Sometimes they have a procedure in their doctor's office, and sometimes they go to a hospital outpatient department. And right now, the differences between those in terms of the kind of care you get and the doctors you see are basically enough. There's no difference. They're the same. And yet the government still pays more if you're having that service done at a hospital outpatient department. So what's happened is a lot of hospitals have started buying private physician practices, and those procedures 2 months earlier were performed in the physician's office and got paid a certain amount. And then the hospital comes in and buy that office, nothing else changes. And all of a sudden you can make, you know, something like double the amount of reimbursement from Medicare.
I wanted to jump in really quick and ask kind of a high level question. We spent a lot of time in the weeds here on these different papers. And sometimes, myself included, people will look at, you know, healthcare cost growth issues, sort of like that old cartoon reference where you've got a hose that's leaking water and you plug one hole, and a new hole opens up and water comes out of that one. With that in mind, looking at this particular paper and then the other third paper that you've already published on capping hospital pricing, what are some of the negative, potential negative ramifications of neutralizing pricing at different locations or capping prices with hospitals? You know, will the cost get shifted to other healthcare providers, down to the actual healthcare customer? Like, what happens here? Is it actually able to drive cost growth down, or is it going to end up springing water somewhere else in the hose?
So, I mean, there are a number of ways I would answer that. The first is that because we're on a Concord Coalition podcast, we like to start from the premise that we need to have some savings in healthcare, that things can't go on the way they are. We're spending too much money per person. The costs are growing faster than inflation and faster than wages. So something needs to be done. So once we start from the premise that something needs to be done, the question is finding the things that should be done that have kind of the, that make the most sense and impact those who can least afford it the least. I mean, I think that's the other premise that we start from. And so why I like talking about this site neutral payment reform is that this is something that is a Medicare payment policy that's existed for a long time. So Congress can change this and then they can save money for Medicare, which is great. But the other thing is that Medicare really drives a lot of what happens in healthcare. And by changing how Medicare pays for something, we can influence change in the overall healthcare system. So this option saves about $150 billion for Medicare. But then if private insurance companies start also moving to site neutral payments, you can save some money in the commercial market. But even more than that, what's happened is that because hospitals get an advantage by buying up physicians' offices, that's been creating consolidation in all of the healthcare markets. So when hospitals and providers are owned by less and less owners, they're able to raise prices for all of us across the board that have commercial insurance. So we think that by Medicare making this kind of small change, if that then convinces the private sector to also make that change, that can actually lessen the incentives for consolidation and wind up with lower healthcare prices and healthcare premiums for all of us. And I think that's the goal, is to change a perverse incentive, an incentive that isn't really helping patients, but it can help patients because you can ultimately make health insurance cheaper and lower the trajectory of federal spending on healthcare, which is really our goal.
Leads me to your last paper, which is just simply capping prices. Hospitals, well, you can go ahead and explain it, but I mean, hospitals get paid more from the private sector, much more than they do for Medicare. The question being why the differential, and how would you actually go about capping prices?
I think the first thing is that we understand that Medicare sets prices administratively. This is something the government just says. This is how much a hospital will get paid for X, Y, and Z. And then the hospital basically has to take Medicare. So they have to take that price that Medicare sets. The commercial market is different. We have a lot of different private insurers, and they negotiate with hospitals for the price of basically all of the services that we get when we're there. But hospitals are kind of trusted community members. There aren't many of them in some areas. In other areas, there's a lot of competition. Hospitals, we also as patients have not a ton of information about which hospitals are good, which hospitals are bad. We know even less about what things cost at one hospital over the other. So sometimes we substitute ideas for how good a hospital is with, are we familiar with the brand name? Is it affiliated with a famous university in the area? And those things are kind of stand-in for quality. So then when an insurance company goes to a hospital to try and negotiate these prices, the hospital is able to demand almost whatever they want because the insurance company doesn't have the luxury of saying, well, we don't want to send you to the George Washington University Hospital. We're not going to have that on your insurance plan. And all of a sudden, everyone who buys that insurance gets very upset because they can no longer go to Georgetown University or George Washington University to have their medical services. So this allows hospitals to get higher prices. And we found that on average, hospitals charge almost twice as much as Medicare, a little bit higher than twice as much as Medicare. But even kind of worse than that is that there are a lot of hospitals that can charge 300 to 400 times what Medicare charges. And this is another one of those things that we all have to pay higher health insurance premiums because hospitals are able to have such high prices. And so we do need to do something about it. Now, what we look at in our brief is what happens if we just cap prices at 200% of Medicare. And we don't really say that because we think that is just a very simple one-line thing that's going to pass in a piece of legislation. What we really want Congress to do is to start thinking about this pool of money that's out there. That is because we have a market failure in hospital pricing. They need to do something about that market failure. And this shows us kind of how much money is out there, almost $1 trillion for higher commercial prices by allowing prices to go higher than 200% of Medicare. So something should be done here. I'm not exactly sure what the right way to do it is, but clearly we need to do something to start impeding this unfettered market power that allows such high prices.
Well, Josh, one thing that, struck me about all three of these proposals is that they have in the past had bipartisan support in one way or the other. So, I mean, do you think there's some hope that as people start looking for ways to pay for new initiatives, that we might be able to find some spending savings from Medicare reform?
Yeah, I think there are two real opportunities, I think, in the near term to have some action on lowering healthcare costs. And I think these options I talked about should be part of the discussion. And those really are the upcoming insolvency of the Medicare Trust Fund, which is projected for 2026. Congress is going to have to take action to do something about that. And one of the things they need to do is start finding some health savings. So I think that provides an opportunity to take some action. And also, the Congress just passed this COVID relief bill that expands the reach of the Affordable Care Act and the insurance subsidies of the Affordable Care Act, but for a very short time. And if Congress has hope of extending those for longer periods of time or making them permanent, they're going to have to find healthcare savings. And I think these are some good areas where they should look for those health savings.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. I have a feeling we could have spent several shows on these topics, Josh. This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Policy Director Tori Gorman, and Director of Health Policy for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Josh Gordon, discuss the ins and outs of CRFB's Health Savers Initiative. Thanks for joining the show, Bob, Tori, and Josh.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, Bob and Tori will be back, joining Concord's National Field Director, Phil Smith, to discuss reconciliation, PAYGO, sequestration, infrastructure, and more. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby, Tori Gorman, and Phil Smith. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Tori is Concord's Policy Director, and Phil is Concord's National Field Director. So basically, we have a huge chunk of the Concord team on today's show. Welcome to Facing the Future, everyone.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you, Chase.
Happy to have you all here today, and we're going to have a bevy of topics in today's show. And I think I'll start things off by going to you, Tori, and asking for a bit of an update on where we are with reconciliation, with the COVID bill. I know most people are probably aware that it's been passed into law, but what's next? What's ahead?
Well, actually, people should check their banking accounts, because apparently the Treasury started sending out checks via electronic funds transfer this weekend. So the effects of the American Recovery Plan should already be showing up in people's bank accounts. As far as additional legislation is concerned, related to that legislation, the House is teeing up a bill this week, H.R. 1868, and it's supposed to address two sequesters that would affect Medicare spending. The budgetary effects of the coronavirus plan that just passed actually triggered a mandatory spending sequester. About $186 billion at the end of this year would be cut across the board on the mandatory side if Congress was not able to enact legislation this year that would eliminate that deficit this year. And it doesn't look like they're going to be able to do that. So the House is acting proactively this week to cancel that sequester. And then we've also got the mandatory sequester that hits Medicare as a result of the Budget Control Act. So they're going to delay that sequester as well. But they're doing so largely to prevent significant reductions in payments to Medicare providers.
Tori, how was sequester triggered here? I mean, I've heard of sequester being part of budget agreements in the past and certain things, you know, tripping the wire that requires a sequester cut across the board. What happened here? How did an emergency relief bill trigger sequester?
We're looking at two different laws that have two different sequester mechanisms in them. The one that was triggered by the bill that passed last week, the COVID relief bill, is a statutory PAYGO sequester. PAYGO meaning pay as you go, which basically says if you pass any legislation that increases direct spending or cuts taxes and creates a deficit as a result of those policies, then at the end of the year, they're going to trigger an across the board cut on the mandatory side in order to prevent an increase in the deficit. So obviously when you pass a $1.9 trillion bill that's deficit financed, or debt financed, I should say, you're gonna trigger that PAYGO sequester.
They've left themselves no choice but to waive sequestration, because the nature of the cuts would be so large that they couldn't do it. So it's not like, you know, they knew they were gonna have to do this when they passed the bill. In fact, I think because if you put all of these various provisions together, because there are limitations on how much can be cut from Medicare, and some things are exempt from sequestration, I believe that if you put it all together, you could not legally cut the amount of money from Medicare that would be needed to satisfy sequestration, because it would exceed the cap that is that, you know, you can't cut more than X percent.
Is it pretty common to waive sequester or sort of set it aside?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point that I wanted to make, Chase, is that, you know, they had to do the same thing with the tax cuts in 2017. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Republicans and Democrats do together. They hold hands at the end of the year. You know, statutory PAYGO was passed into law in 2010. And I'm trying to think, I don't remember a time when it's actually ever been used. We've always just avoided the problem by either delaying the report that triggers sequester, or by zeroing out the PAYGO scorecard altogether so that there is no sequester. Part of it is just that the politics of this too. I mean, the Medicare sequester cuts, they don't fall on beneficiaries in that their benefits aren't cut, but they fall on the payments, the reimbursements to providers. And in the middle of a global pandemic, when we're asking so much of our healthcare providers, To ask them to do that with less money. I mean, you can understand the politics of that situation.
Sure.
So, but I guess my wish was that we had, maybe we had saved zeroing out the scorecard for a situation like this and hadn't done it so many times in the past.
Right. So let's take a step back or zoom out, I guess, a little bit on our perspective here on policy. We've been a little deep in the weeds on sequester. An infrastructure bill is probably on the horizon, and there's talk of maybe trying to make it bipartisan, and maybe there will be pay-fors. You know, so what are we hearing? What's it look like in terms of a potential infrastructure plan? Is it going to end up in the reconciliation pile?
Well, let me kind of set the big picture. The next big step is we're waiting for President Biden's budget. He will have presumably some major proposals in that budget. Some of them might be released separately, like an infrastructure plan or climate change, or, you know, he's already released an immigration bill. But it's all going to be packaged together in a budget. And there are several key issues that we need to think about at this point, because the emergency relief part of it is done. And now we're talking about the regular budget. So the idea that things need to be done on an emergency basis, and that means not paying for new initiatives, that phase is gone. When we look at the new budget, I mean, the Concord Coalition is certainly going to look at what new initiatives, how expensive are they, and how are they going to pay for it. Plus, you've got some leftover items. Let's not forget that a lot of the 2017 tax cuts, the ones for individuals, expired in 2025. So there's a revenue cost to extending those. Plus, the COVID bill that just passed had a major expansion of the child credit, child tax credit, and some other provisions, earned income tax and credit, and other provisions that Democrats really want to make permanent, but they didn't have to pay for it in the COVID bill because it's an emergency. But if you start talking about it as part of the regular budget and you're going to make it permanent, then that's a major new expense that would have to be offset somehow, presumably. So those are like old items, the tax cuts and the new child tax credits. And then you've got the, you know, whatever new items that the president, including the infrastructure, which could be pretty large, that the president comes up with. So that's gotten a lot of people wondering, okay, so what is the pay for part of this? Is there going to be a tax provision? And if so,
multiple,
you know, how big, how much of the new initiatives would be paid for, and how? And how?
How European will our tax structure get moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you can't do all this without some sort of a tax increase. And they know that. And so the easy part is over. The COVID bill is hugely popular because we need a big COVID bill. Plus, there are no pay-fors. So there's nothing unpopular about it. It's all plus. If you start talking about pluses and minuses, that's where you get really, really, you start getting a lot of friction, not just from Republicans, but from the public, because they'll realize that there are tax increases along with the benefit increases.
So we've talked a lot about the policy end of this, and Phil, we haven't heard from you yet. So I wanted to bring you into the conversation.
Thank you.
Obviously the Concord Coalition is very focused on grassroots and field activities, and you're the national field director. So you're plugged right into to what we're doing and what we're hearing from our volunteers across the country. And that's my question. What's the response largely by the public, by our volunteers, with how large these numbers are, you know, where it's focused, how it impacts overall fiscal policy?
It's been an interesting year for sure. And our fiscal lookouts, we have dozens of fiscal lookouts. Those are our statewide volunteers across the country. One of the things that's always distinguished the Concord Coalition from other groups is that we have people outside the national capital area, right? So we have people like Chase up in New Hampshire, and I'm coming to you today from Georgia, from Alaska down to Florida and lots of places in between. But it's been such an interesting year. And one of the things that the Concord Coalition has been, where we've been able to play to our strengths, is explaining what's happening, because there's just been so much. You've heard a little snippet just over the past few minutes of what's happening right now. But the trillions and trillions of dollars in legislation that's been passed over the past year is of great interest, of course, to our volunteers and to citizens across the country. And they know, they feel it just like we do. These are eye-popping numbers. But they also understand that when you're sick, you've got to take medicine. But then hopefully when you get done being sick, you're done with your medicine. So, you know, I think the question is now, where is that point? You know, and we take too much medicine at some point, I think, is a question that some of our people in the field are wondering. But I also sense a real hunger, because one of the other reasons that people are attracted to a group like the Concord Coalition is this age-old vestige that we don't see much anymore of bipartisan leadership. And they hope that we're going to see more of that in the future. It was unfortunate that, you know, this bill passed without any, you know, bipartisan support to speak of. And so if we move to an infrastructure bill next, I think one of the things that Concord Coalition volunteers and people across the country really, really hope is that we can find a way for some bipartisanship in there, because these problems are just way too big for one party to take on all by itself. And it seems like every time a party in the past tried to do this by themselves, they eventually got punished for it by the voters. So I hope the politicians remember that.
Yeah, and that's a really good lay of the land there, Phil, for fiscal policy now and moving forward. And we have said many times in the show that the COVID relief measures that have been passed have been very necessary to respond to the emergency. And you need to support the economy, support people, support businesses, especially when it's sort of a self-imposed economic decline, because we voluntarily shut down the economy to try and get through COVID-19. And now that we're starting to plan for the future, plan for those long-term policy decisions, you need to start looking at the big picture again. And this is a terrible, terrible segue on my part, but you mentioned at the beginning of your remarks that I'm in New Hampshire working for the organization. And I actually have a little bit of news on my end. I'm going to be moving from a staff member with the Concord Coalition to a volunteer fiscal lookout. So I'm going to be joining the ranks of the dozens of individuals across the country that work on their own time to help Concord out and spread the message of federal fiscal responsibility, because I've decided to take a new position within the governor's administration, working for an agency that's actually helping manage federal COVID relief dollars. So it was an incredible opportunity that came before me. It's been an absolute pleasure working for the Concord Coalition, working with all of you, hosting Facing the Future. But unfortunately, all good things occasionally come to an end, at least for now. And I am going to be handing the reins over to Bob Bixby, the very capable expert hands and voice of Bob, who's been a regular contributor on the show. So I'm going to hand it over to you for a second, Bob, after I just dropped that bomb on our audience.
Mercy, I had no idea.
I will say all of my colleagues knew this was coming, at least before this show. So,
well, we all gathered on this broadcast so we could appropriately kick Chase out the door. This was frankly the only way we could pry his hands off of the microphone.
Oh, right? Thank
No, you know, Chase, you have had an incredible hidden talent that nobody knew about. We didn't know when we hired you that you were such a good radio host. I don't know whether you had ever thought of that as a career, but when we had this opportunity to begin the show on WKXL, you know, Chase was there in New Hampshire and was there to be the host. And we did our first show with Bob Carey, who is our co-chair. And I remember going over the studio with Chase and I was thinking, well, you know, I'll probably jump in and do most of the questioning here. And Chase may be a little shy and, you know, co-chair and, you know.
That was before Bob knew me very well.
I was going to say, wow.
If I got in a word edgewise, I think in the first 15 minutes of the show, I'm sitting there just waiting and waiting and waiting. And Chase is saying, well, one more question here. And he's, you know, having a great conversation with Bob Carey. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, okay.
Firing one.
But as
3 years later, I'm finally giving Bob a chance to actually have the microphone back.
Well, as I'll tell you, I don't relish it, because the reason that I didn't jump in was I realized that you were doing a great job interviewing Bob Carey, and I didn't want to ruin it. So you've been doing a great job ever since, Chase, and it really, you have a great way of handling guests on the program, asking good questions, asking good follow-ups, and you know, people enjoy being on the program with you. So you know, we certainly you will certainly be missed.
Well, I appreciate that, Bob, and to your point earlier, I had no aspirations of being a radio host or podcast host of any kind. That certainly wasn't you know, in the long-term career path, but it has been a lot of fun along the way, and certainly a learning experience. I'll give you that. Now we can brag that it's actually the number one ranked fiscal and economic policy program in the world, which is kind of cool.
I love it.
Big shoes there, Bob. Big shoes.
So I leave you with that.
But anyway.
Well, and no, Chase, it just it comes at a time when it's so needed too. As I say, necessity is the mother of invention, and we needed you. There's a sea of misinformation out there, and unfortunately, a lot of the good information oftentimes, you know, is behind a paywall. So for the record, Facing the Future is not behind a paywall.
Free.
You know, you can access it. And I just think back to so many different shows. And thank you so much for highlighting what we do in the field. Oftentimes, you've brought in so many of our volunteer leaders from across the country. And one show that stands out, I think my favorite guest was probably someone named Guest, Dr. Jody Guest, who was an epidemiologist. And we, that show, oh my gosh, it went, the social media went crazy afterwards on that one. And I think it shows that we were talking about, you know, well, obviously we have a healthcare crisis occurring, but the juxtaposition of that healthcare crisis and what we talk about federal budget policy, because you, frankly, you can't talk about the future of federal budget policy without talking about healthcare.
Right.
So that was a good one. But my mind is just flooded with all these incredible moments, and you clearly have some talent.
Well, I appreciate that. This was not a, hey, give me a pat on the back segment, but I'm having fun.
Oh, Chase, I got to say, when I was on the Senate Budget Committee, one of the traditions we had is when someone would leave, we'd ask them to say their best and their worst experience on the committee. And the worst were always really hysterical, and the best were really, really, really fulfilling. So my question to you is, as you look back over 3 years on Facing the Future, what are sort of the, you know, the highlights that stick out for you? And what are some of the lowlights that you learned from?
Oh, wow. Well, way to put me on the spot, because this is our 160th show.
So
we've had a lot of guests and a lot of great conversations. So I am hard pressed to pick a favorite or a best memory, or really even a worst, because I'm sure there's been some doozies there as well. But I think what I really enjoyed about the program is, to Phil's point, it was substantive, or it still is. It's going to continue to be substantive. My favorite thing about the show is that we get into the weeds, and we're not afraid to talk about the sticky policy issues and try to navigate the political waters in that. And so that, to that extent, it's been very rewarding in a bit of a turbulent media environment to have these very substantive guests on the show talking about real world issues and fiscal policy that impact every single one of us. The worst experiences or the low lights usually are a reflection of me, something I messed up on, whether it's a recording or
the technology just doesn't cooperate.
Exactly. I can't think of a guest where I thought, man, we probably shouldn't have had them on the show. It's usually man, I should have handled that guest better, because it could have been such a better interview if I had just had my stuff together. But that's part of the learning process, I think. And I think we've improved along the way. So there were a lot more highlights than lowlights, especially in recent years, despite the fact that we've been in the middle of a pandemic and trying to figure that out as well.
Well, I can tell you my least favorite shows, they were the one where you were on paternity leave and I was trying to fill in for you.
It's hard to say goodbye. I'm excited where the organization is going, where the show is going. And I think there's going to be a lot of great conversations and a lot of great work ahead.
Well, and Concord Coalition has a a big track record of hiring back people that were employees.
I may be back sooner rather than later.
I'm looking forward to the day when you fight Mark Millsap again.
Everybody on this call, raise your hand if you worked for Concord once and then came back to work for Concord later.
For those who can't see, that's everyone.
I plead guilty, and Larry King might be dead and gone, but the Larry King of the federal budget world will always be with us, Chase. So you'll always have a seat in the studio.
Thanks, Phil.
And I can tell you all that you'll probably be seeing and hearing more of Phil Smith and Tory Gorman as we go on. As co-host with me and guest host, and we will continue to try to bring you the best guests, both from inside Washington and from the field.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, your new incoming host of the program, Concord's Policy Director Tory Gorman, and Concord's National Field Director Phil Smith. Thank you for joining Facing the Future, Bob, Tory, and Phil.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks. Thank you, Chase.
Good luck, Chase.
Thank you all. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman, signing off for the last time. Thanks for listening.